Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran.
Quote, "One of the biggest things I've learned in both the military and agriculture is that success isn't just about what you know. It's about who you surround yourself with. If you build the right team and focus on the mission, you can accomplish just about anything." End quote. In this episode, I'm joined by Charlie Jordan, a retired U.S. Army aviator and special operations veteran who has channeled his military experience into a thriving career in floriculture and veteran mentorship. Charlie shares his journey from flying MH-47 Chinooks with the 160th Special Operations Aviation Unit to building Jordan Farms in Tennessee, where he grows specialty flowers for his community. We talk about the challenges of transitioning out of the military, the importance of mentorship, and how programs like the Tennessee Ag Vols are helping veterans step into agriculture with confidence. If you're a veteran looking to carve out your own place in agriculture, or just want to hear an inspiring story of resilience and reinvention, this episode is for you. Let's get into it.
I grew up as an Army brat. I traveled a lot. Again, lots of family members been in the military. I was raised by my grandparents, Army recruiter himself. So we traveled around, ended up staying in Gulf Breeze, Florida, near Pensacola Beach, and that's where I grew up as a skateboarding surfer kid. And of course, my future I kind of knew was going to be military. I mean, that just kind of seemed how it was going to go, and I had no issues with that at all. So I joined at the ripe old age of 18 and decided, hey, this is something that I wanted to do. I didn't realize it at first, but first 6 months in the Army, I said, this is pretty cool. So I decided to stay. I had lots of different jobs throughout the military. Honestly, I had several different MOSs or skills. And I ended up settling on aviation as my last one, and decided after some time flying conventional aviation, decided to put my packet in and assess for the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, and was selected. And spent about 15 years of my career there, and ended up retiring in 2017. After about 28 and a half years in the military, I retired as a Chief Warrant Officer 4. And right now I've decided that I want to be an agricultural professional. So here I am.
lots to unpack there. I would assume that most of that early path towards the military was from your grandparents and all of the other family members that surrounded you.
Yes. I was raised by a Holocaust survivor, my grandmother. Wow. She instilled lots of great values and lots of great beliefs in me. My grandfather being, a career military Vietnam veteran himself. So lived in a very strict household. But those were those formative years that I really needed that. Even though I didn't receive, a lot of the, stuff that I was looking for as a kid, I kind of found that in the military. And that's what I really kind of stuck with me was, the discipline, I had a schedule that was set for me. So all those things kind of clicked for me. So it just seemed to work.
Did your grandmother ever talk much about her time?
She did once in a while, not much though. It was hard for her to talk about per se. But the one story that she would always tell me is that when she did arrive off the train, and when she arrived there and she was in line to be separated from her mother, and she came up to the guard, the German guard. And basically he said, "You look like my granddaughter." And that was it. And she was put off to another line. And luckily, she survived. And she did the majority of the war, she was in factories building airplanes, is what she did on the North Sea of Germany. So, she survived and found her way to the United States. Had five kids and raised them all well, and had me as a grandkid and raised me too. So it was an amazing experience. It really was. Looking back now, when I was growing up, I really didn't take a lot of those things in consideration. I was young, things didn't really kind of click for me. I just knew what, her story. And it never really kind of set into me until way later on in in adult years, when I really looked back and was like, wow, that was pretty amazing, and what she did, and my grandfather also. So it was quite the stories that I heard. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a different breed of folks.
Very much so. Totally. And my grandmother is, along with my mother, they're the ones that instilled the gardening in me. I always remember having a big garden growing up in Florida in the backyard. And it was always full of everything you can think of. And her favorite was strawberries. So she had her nice strawberry patch, and I happened to have a pet tortoise that lived in my backyard. And it used to always eat her strawberries. So that was always a contentious subject between us, but it was awesome learning those different things. I mean, just her, how she grew up and the things she would tell me about. She learned English basically reading the newspaper. She used to dig out of garbage cans for potato peelings, and that's how she would eat, and she didn't like agriculture because her daddy always made her go out and feed the pigs, and she didn't like that. But she loved gardening, and that just kind of instilled in me also.
Was your grandfather in the army in Vietnam?
Yes, he was. He was an army. He was a tanker in Vietnam, which was in a whole world of its own. So he told me some very, very, interesting stories about his time over there. And it was really cool to hear some of them. So yeah.
And so was it because of that army service that you settled on the army as well?
Yes, I mean my father, he died when I was very young. He died when I was about 9 months old. He was actually 6 months old, sorry. He was in Air Force basic training, unfortunately passed away in Air Force basic training. And my stepfather was Army aviator. Also, my grandfather again was Vietnam tanker. And I had uncles who actually stormed the beaches of Normandy in D-Day. So it's been this long history of military service, and it's all I've ever known. The proverbial green ID card my entire life. I've had it since the day my feet hit the floor. And it, you know, it, it, I grew up in the military, and it just kind of stuck with me. And I saw that as, something I wanted to do. It wasn't really my only choice. My other choice was trying to be a professional surfer in California, and I didn't think that was really going to work out too well. So the military seemed the best choice for me, and I'm so glad I did it. It really, it kept me on the straight and narrow throughout life. Gave me a career. I had a blast traveling around the world and seeing all the different places and the people. So it was really a fantastic journey. It really was.
I feel like just based off what you described, your family needs to come together and put a book together on all of those previous experiences.
Yeah, the surviving members of my family, unfortunately, there's only a few of us left, but we've actually thought about that, based on what my grandmother's experiences and also my grandfather's, and just where we came from and on that part. So it was really interesting.
How in the army, because I was a Marine, so this ability to sort of transfer between different MOSs is somewhat foreign to me. How does that work?
Well, basically at the now, I'm not familiar with how they, now and the current situation, but when I was going in, this was, again, I came in the late 80s, 90s, 2000s. But what basically I would do, my first job was logistics. I had only enlisted for 2 years, because that was still an option you could do back in the late 80s. And I decided, hey, that's what I would undo. I just want to stay in for a few years. That's what I thought. And I want to get the college money, right? So I decided to stay in 2 years, and I think I was, within about, I don't know, I think all my training When it was completed, I only had about a year and a half left in the military, my first tour. So I decided, kind of bored with this logistics thing. I'm gonna trade, trade my MOS and do something else. So I reenlisted for a new job, and I picked air defense. And I stayed in air defense for a while, and I kind of got bored of that, and I reenlisted again, and I decided I'd be a military police. And then I did some combat engineer stuff too, and then ended up making my way to Fort Novosel, former Fort Rucker down in Alabama, and I was an MP there. And a buddy of mine came there, and he said, "Hey," he was already in the 160. He said, "Hey, why don't you go to this flight school? It's pretty cool." I said, "Well, I don't know. I'm scared of heights. I don't know if it's gonna work out." And he's like, "Hey, man, just try it." I was like 10 years in. I was a staff sergeant, E6 in the Army, and I said, "Okay, I'll give it a shot." So I put in my packet and got selected, and I had no idea I was gonna get selected. And I decided, I'm going to flight school. And I got over the height thing, kind of, not really, but I did. I was inside the helicopter, not on the outside of it. So it kind of helped me out a little bit, and I decided to stay in aviation for a while. And my first tour was in Korea, and then I went to the 101st Airborne here at Fort Campbell. I'd already been here at Fort Campbell before, and it's somewhere I wanted to come back to here in Kentucky, Tennessee area. And then I decided I wanted to step up past the 101st Airborne and go to the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, which my stepfather actually had some history with them before, and I was like, "That's something I want to do." Successfully assessed for it, and I spent the last 15 years of my career there. And, absolutely loved it. Loved every part of it. The people, the mission, just the Army in itself, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a whole other story about transitioning out of there. But my time there was, it was magical. It really was. That's about the best statement I can put. I met some of the most outstanding people, visited some amazing places, flew some of the most highly advanced aircraft, in the inventory today. And it was an amazing journey, and it will always definitely be with me for my entire life. So,
What
yeah.
did you fly? You mentioned helicopters?
Yes, I was a MH-47 aviator or pilot. So I flew
Is
Chinooks for my career. That's
that's
what I
right.
flew. I flew regular CH-47s in the conventional Army, and then when I went to the 160th, I flew advanced helicopters. So yeah, it was fantastic. I loved it.
Those were on their way out when I was coming through. The 53s were in sort of primary use. The Ospreys were sort of all the new greatest thing. We were doing some training in 29 Palms, California, with some 40 set 40 CH-46s, the frogs. And we were taking them up just over a mountain pass somewhere out in that area. So, I mean, a few thousand feet up, it wasn't too high. But I don't know if it was just because it was so full or because the air was so thin there, but I remember that flight in particular as a struggle for that particular aircraft. And I mean, there was hydraulic fluid coming down on everybody on the inside, and it was an interesting time in those few flights with that aircraft.
Oh yeah, usually with tandem aircraft, tandem rotor aircraft, I mean, if it was leaking anything, that means it was running successfully and it was actually working well. When it stopped leaking, that's when you need to really be concerned.
You said you flew other things. What else did you fly?
I did well, yeah. During my training, I got to fly different aircraft. When you go through flight school, back when I went through, we flew OH-58 Charlies, the scout helicopter, and then I flew TH-67s, which is like it's a Bell model helicopter, has some instrument capabilities, and then I stepped up to after that to the aircraft I wanted to fly, and that was the Chinook. So, and I finished out my flight school with my Chinook qualification. And that's when I went to the regular Army after that, to the 101st, and also Korea, and then again to the 160th. So yeah, and then during 160th time, I got to fly in a little bird. Didn't get to fly it per se. I wasn't qualified in it, but I got to fly it a little bit in it. But my main aircraft the whole time was the 47. So yeah.
Those little birds are the real small ones that carry like
Yes.
six packs with the real round
Yes.
dome in the
They're
front.
pretty cool. Yeah, they can do some pretty darn amazing things. Yes, they
I've
can.
seen some of them, never in person or in operation, but just in different videos where
Yes.
they are doing some things you wouldn't think a helicopter could do.
Right. Skills.
Yeah.
Got some skills. Yes.
Do you still have your pilot license in the private sector?
I have a equivalency, so I do have my commercial helicopter, and then I'll also my main bread and butter is my remote pilot and command for uncrewed systems. So that's
Drones.
the other license that I hold also.
For drones or UAS
For
platforms.
drones, UAS, right? I'm
Got it.
I teach it for Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and then
Oh, wow.
also I've had a previous my own business with drone photography here locally. So
Got it. Interesting. I
yeah.
am wholly unfamiliar with the 160th Aviation Regiment. Can you describe what sort of role they play and what their mission is?
Their mission is Special Operations Aviation. I
Okay.
won't get in obviously in great detail on it, but
Sure.
they're basically to prosecute any target worldwide plus or minus 30 seconds. And we do a dang good job of it. And I still say that I'm part of it, but I know I'm not right now, but in my heart, I really am. And they just do an amazing mission throughout the world. So, spending many years with them and areas around the world, of course, Afghanistan, Iraq, and just the camaraderie. Just the mission itself, the purpose, every day, waking up, I had a purpose every day when I went into the to my unit, and I absolutely loved that. There's no questioning what I was going to do for the day. I knew it was going to be something that was going to be awesome, and that's what motivated me every day to go into work.
Do they do close air support as well as troop transport, or is it primarily one or the other?
They do a little bit of everything
A little bit of everything. Okay.
around the whole gamut.
Okay.
That's the amazing part of it, is being pretty much self-sustaining. We rely, obviously Special Operations relies on its conventional family to help out. But definitely the mission-wise, it's an incredible thing to just see the collaborations and the connections and all the networking and everything to come together to make, an hour and a half mission absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Do they is the sort of medical evacuation or casualty evacuation stuff also a part of their mission, or does that fall more toward the Blackhawks and the kind of conventional sort of things?
It's CASAVAC. Everybody responsible, for that. It's all set up in missions and stuff like that. But main always being that, our primary ground force that we're, supporting is that's our main, that's
Got
our
it.
main per thing.
Got it.
So, and
Okay.
anything they need, that's what we would supply for them.
And you spent 15 years with them.
Yes.
Wow.
And it was fantastic. And I was, short timer. Lots of people have spent longer times with them, but I definitely cherish those 15 years. It
Yeah,
was
no
absolutely
kidding.
amazing.
I like to ask guests, and this is especially true for you, I think, because you've done so many things. Is there one particular story, event, good or bad, that occurred through any of those 28, almost 29 years that you still sort of reach back to today that has influenced the way you do things or is a lesson learned that is always with you?
Not, I would say not any particular one. I would just say my entire time as being a soldier, everything I did, there's so many stories in it. I mean, being in that long, you do, you just, I grew up there. I went in when I was 18. I came out when I was 46 years old. Lots of stories in between that time, and not really one particular one, because sometimes they kind of all sometimes mesh together for me. But just, to say one time, I'd have to just go back to my time with the
Sure.
160th. It's just anything part of that. I go back to that because there were so many good lessons learned, not only just, military wise, but just in life, and things that I learned. And really, I grew up there. and learn so many things. And I take literally just pieces of each little experience that I've had, and I mesh those all together to really, kind of form who I am today. With other stuff also, I've been out now since 2017, so I've kind of meshed into the civilian world a little bit. But my background is pure military, and I really like to grab those experiences of discipline, integrity, perseverance, all those things. Those are what drives me pretty much today in the things that I do. And I take all those experience I had, every one of them is just key to who I am today.
After such a long career, when did you know and why that it was time to move on?
I was getting close. I think after about 25 years, when I hit my 25-year mark, I kind of knew that the time was coming. I had no desire to move any farther than the rank that I was currently, like to call it the terminal rank for me, which was a CW4. I had no intentions of moving up to Chief Warrant Officer 5. I was where I was at, and I was okay with that because I had already in my mind, I had started to already, I'd already been forming my post-military career. I was already looking at, what direction am I going to go? And this is something I talk to transitioning veterans all the time about now, is that I was already set in a direction I wanted to go. I knew I was leaving to not go to corporate, the world, corporate world. I knew I wasn't going to the defense industry. I knew I was going towards agriculture. And I had to really, start to look at that and say to myself, okay, if you're going to do this, you need to get yourself ready. Because you're getting out of the military. It's all you've ever known. That getting paid twice a month thing is going to stop. You're not going to get all those nice pays and benefits anymore. So the financial part, came, as reality kind of smack in the face. So all those things I had to really start looking at. And that's why me personally, I took complete 100% advantage of the transitioning programs leaving the military. I had already started to grab them. I started making appointments, looking at things. And then once I ended up about my 27th year, I was already kind of set on where the direction I was going. And everything pretty much after that was just kind of falling in place as far as, formalities of the military and actually separating and retiring from it, which I thought I was actually ready for it. But as soon as that, that next month hit, and I was out, and this is probably around, I don't know, March of 2020 or 2017, reality really smacked me in the face. And a lot of things just, kind of came together at that point. And I had to really dig down deep inside. The career that I'd known my entire life, that was proverbially over. The marriage that I was in for 20 years of that was, over, at the same time. And I was trying to build a business, with, basically assets that I didn't know I was even going to have again after a few months, because it was so tumultuous, through the 6 months after I, decided to re get out in February 2017. Those next 6 months were probably some of the hardest things I've ever had to deal with in my entire life. Even in combat was easier than what I had to deal with once I separated from the army. And it
Because
was
of
something that I, yeah, go ahead.
the divorce at the same time, or just
Lots that, lots of things. I mean, being in this long, I mean, I call it, basically institutional man. That's all I'd ever known. I, my schedule was made for me. There was, there's, three times a day you could eat, and then you knew where you had to be. You knew where you were going. You knew when you were coming back sometimes. And all those things, that's how I grew up with that. And that's how my life was. And literally it was like the door just shuts closed and it's cut off right then. And it's a heck of a feeling. And I'm saying from someone who'd spent so long And there is people that definitely have spent longer than me. But when I talk to them, we all have the same feeling. We all felt the same way. Was a period of like a sense of loss, you know, of oh my goodness, you know, everything I'd ever known is vanished, and not really vanished, but it's gone. The you know, access to the gate that I used to go back and forth in for 15 years of my life, you know, I can no longer go in that gate. That parking spot that I used to park in front of the hangar, you know, for 10 plus years, well, it somebody else is parking there now, you know. So all those things, you know, were really tested me personally inside, but it just all around. I had to really had to define myself again and who I was. I was no longer Chief Warrant Officer for Charlie Jordan, you know. I was just the civilian Charlie Jordan. And I had to really work and go and define who I wanted to be again. You know, did I just wanted to be another statistic, or did I want to be somebody who stepped up and said, you know what, I'm going to be who I am, and I'm going to be a veterpreneur, and I'm going to have Jordan Farms, you know, and that's what I strived for.
What was that first step that you took as a part of that redefinition process?
I would say the first part was to not, I guess, continue to just identify myself as, again, Chief Warrant Officer for Charlie Jordan. You know, I had to say I am now Mr. Charlie Jordan. I'm going to be a business owner, and that's the way it's going to be. So I basically, after, you know, again, it was tumultuous. My divorce was settled about a year after I got out, and I started really concentrating into what I wanted to do. So again, agriculture is where I wanted to be. I was already farming. I've been farming since 2001. I was living at my property already. Yeah, that's a fun story about my times in agriculture and being in the 160th. So yeah, that was a challenge. But I decided, you know, what I was going to do. I was in cattle for the longest time, and freezer beef operation. I had a herd of Texas Longhorns and Herefords that I was running, and I decided I really want to do that no more. I wanted to do something else. Not that I don't love cattle and the cattle industry. It's just I personally got tired of waking up about 3 in the morning and having to chase a bull down the highway. Just something I did not want to do anymore. I had other things I really wanted to do, and so I decided to take on horticulture. It wasn't something I was like, okay, let me just try it out. I had a my first year again, 2017, I was trying it out, and I ordered a bunch of tomatoes, and I tried this tomato operation, and it failed really badly. And one thing that survived for me was my companion planting, and companion planting is obviously different things we plant with our main crops. So I decided to plant some old zinnia flower seeds and some old sunflower seeds that I had laying around, and I threw those out in the garden with the rest of the tomatoes. All the tomatoes were dead, but my flowers were still living. And I was like, maybe I'm onto something. So I decided from that point, I spent the next 6 months of my time and 20 about the beginning of 2018 is going out and visiting all kinds of flower farms throughout the Southeast. I immersed myself in every type of floriculture book, flower book, horticulture book, anything you could ever think of. I just totally immersed myself because that's just my personality. I get hyper focused on things. So I really dug deep. I'm a voracious reader and a researcher. So I dug everything out I could. And my first year was 2018. I decided to take 5 bouquets to the market. And I sold those 5 bouquets in less than 5 minutes. And I was like, I think this is where I want to go. Since 2017, 2018, I've been digging into this floriculture operation, and it's been fantastic. Not only is it, you know, for me, satisfies me personally inside, it also gives back to my community. I look at farmers as two-time volunteers. I look at myself as a three-time volunteer. First, we volunteered for the military, and then the next time we volunteered to feed our communities. For me, I was a three-time. I volunteered for the Army, I volunteered for the 160th, and then I volunteered to be a farmer also. And I can't think of something better than waking up and going out to my fields and looking at them and just going, man, this is pretty amazing. You know, I did this. You know what I mean? No one else did it. You know, I'm the one that went out there and did this. And I think that's the entire beauty of being an entrepreneur, is that I'm the boss. Now, I do have one boss. Her name is Mother Nature, and I do have to discuss things with her on a daily basis. But for me, it's me. Everything that happens on this farm is a direct result of me, or Mother Nature sometimes. But anything that goes good, that's for me. If it goes bad, well, it's on me too, you know? So it's a learning lesson every day. I haven't found, I mean, except for the military personally, entrepreneurship for me has been just so soul satisfying. You know, I'm an independent contractor. So again, I mentioned I'm an adjunct professor for and a course developer for Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And but also, you know, I'm a farmer. That's what I do, you know, and that's where I, you know, my love is, my passion. Being able to grow these flowers for my community. And you know, I started out with one market. And now this year we have four markets this year. So it's been amazing. The support for my community has been phenomenal. They really have wrapped their arms, you know, around it. And you know, I've never gave a bouquet to somebody, and the result, you know, has never been a frown. It's always been a smile, no matter what. You know what I mean? I mean, they look at it, they smile, they just, you know, they can't believe it, you know. And it's like, you know, that really, you know, that satisfies the soul for me. You know, it really does.
It does certainly seem like what was a coincidence, as flowers that remained as companions after a tomato crop has grown into this passion for you and this kind of rediscovery of a purpose that felt maybe closed after the time with the army was done. How do you decide what to grow, how much to grow? I mean, how do you sort of put these things together?
It was a system. Honestly, I did not have a plan my first year. Obviously, I just bought some seeds, threw them out. But after I did, you know, some research, some study, I looked at different techniques of different floriculturists or farmer flower farmers and how they were doing things. Because I'm a soul, you know, that's all I do. I do flowers. So a lot of people do different things. They do vegetables and stuff like that. Now I do have small veg area mainly for myself, and we do grow some stuff for a organization called Amana Cafe here locally. It's for homeless, and they feed the homeless. So we do grow a little bit for them, and we also do flowers for them also. But it kind of just started. I was looking at how, you know, how am I going to make this successful? I had to, you know, look at growing times, growing season. I had to figure out when my market time was, you know. So this was stuff I had to dig up. Now you can look on the internet and you can find anything you want to. Of course, AI can even, you know, plan out your entire flower season for you if you write in the right prompts. But you know, when I started, there really wasn't. There was books and there was other farmers to go look at. So I had to kind of decide on my own, how am I going to be able to, you know, provide for my community the flowers that I want to provide for them in the growing zone that I'm in with the weather that I have, and what varieties are successful for my area. And I kind of started there. And I base everything, you know, on my customers, is how I do it. So my research is done for the next season's market. So the 2026 market research is being conducted now. My market research started January 1st because 2025 to me is pretty much over, for planning. It's done. My planning happens in July of every year. So what I do is I start looking at my customers' actions, you know, their buying habits, which flowers they enjoy the most, which ones they don't like the most, which flowers I like growing and which ones I don't like growing. Bachelor buttons right now are a flower I probably will never grow again. And that's just personal preference. So I base all that. I come up with a plan. And then I work with my growers and my my broker that handles a lot of my stuff for me. And I look and I go out and I find the best quality plants from the best growers I can find. And that's all established. I give myself till August 1st to have my plan done for the next year.
Okay.
Because once Labor Day hits, it's vacation time for me. And it's over. So I may do a couple of therapeutic horticulture events for the fall time period. But after that, I'm on vacation. The fields are, dead. They're just sitting there. I'm not doing anything. And then we'll start cleanup sometime late fall. And
Okay.
then I'll, and then we'll get ready again. And come the third week of February, that's when the next plants start coming in for the year. And I've been planting now for 2 straight weeks.
Yeah, right.
So
Right. I've
a
seen
lot.
some of your setup on LinkedIn. It's really impressive.
Appreciate it.
Are
Thank you.
the hoop houses that you use with that
Yes.
paper that's down, with the holes
Yes.
that you punked it, has
Yes.
that, I'm assuming a lot of that plastic is down for weed control, and the hoop houses are there to try to regulate temperature?
My hoop house is for season extension. So, and
Oh,
also
okay.
early season start. So
Okay.
my advertised time period is Mother's Day to Labor Day. So
Okay.
my growing starts the second week of February for my Mother's Day market. That's one of my biggest markets of the year. It's the first market of the year. So my main concentration right now is that Mother's Day weekend, May 10th, right now of 2025.
Okay.
That's the bullseye on the wall for me. Everything is focused right now towards that date. I don't even I'm not looking past that right now. And that's where all our concentration goes. So the hoop house gives me the ability to start early, and it gives me the ability to finish later in the season. So my very colorful the white flowers, pink flowers, the real light color stuff. My Mother's Day snapdragons, stuff like that, I start those in the hoop house. And
Got
what
it.
you're seeing on the ground is called landscape fabric. And I use that to basically help me manage my weeds. I'm pretty much a two-person show out here for the majority of time. So it's about a 3-acre flower operation now, compared to just 2 rows of 100 feet. So we're about 3 acres now. And working, having to, work weeds and weed management, which is a daily thing.
Right.
The landscape fabric gives me a little bit of an edge, when it comes to that. So I'm not dealing with the big open field anymore. I'm only dealing with the 2 inch, hole that's burned into the fabric itself.
Yeah.
And it makes it a lot easier to manage.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, we've got a few acres here that we farm just small for us, and we've tried all manner of things for weed management. And we've got some of that landscape fabric down for certain areas. We've done cardboard and mulch on top to try to keep some of those weeds down. It's, you're right, it's just a continuous process.
It is. It never ends. It
How
really
did
doesn't.
you and Bryce meet?
It was me and Bryce met totally by accident. It was through the basically the process of getting hired on with the Ag Vols grant project that we're on.
Okay.
I have heard his name before, I think, through a networking contact. But he apparently had heard of me prior to and stuff. So it was really nice to have him come on as a partner on this grant.
Yeah.
So.
And so what that program is doing, just based on the conversation I had with Bryce, is really interesting. And one of the things that stood out most to me was that they will field inquiries and make connections in a huge variety of different needs and requests. I can
Yes.
imagine horticulture all the way to cattle production. Anywhere
All
from
of it.
I have this thing I want to do to I have this business plan already. I have some early funding. I have the land. How do I tweak or make this process more efficient? And so that was a really impressive and interesting aspect of this program as a whole. And I wanted to ask you more about your specific role as the veteran membership coordinator.
Yeah, so it's mentorship actually.
All right. Yeah,
So
sorry.
I'm the mentorship program coordinator have it. So it's divided up. Of course Bryce handles the outreach side, I'm handling the mentorship side. My portion of it is right now what we work with and working on is we want to provide mentorship internship opportunities for the transitioning service members out of Fort Campbell is our primary right now in year one. And then we're going to expand out in year two and three to include the veterans throughout the state of Tennessee. So right now, my focus is within the 50 statute miles of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, on the Tennessee side. And what we're doing is right now I have 8 host farms and organizations that will host a transitioning service member out of Fort Campbell utilizing the Career Skills Program. They will go ahead and apply to be an intern on one of these 8 different host farms, again, industry, and also we have education now on there, an extension agent. And they will apply for that. They get accepted. They will do an 8-week internship mentorship at that farm or host of their choice. So they'll spend and it's all between that transitioning service member and the host mentor to come up with the schedule and what they're doing. But the things we have to actually provide for them currently is, well, my farm, of course, is one of the host internship farms. So
Yep.
you'll get floriculture at my farm. A friend of mine that's down the road from me about 15, 20 minutes, he's also on the program, and you're going to get horticulture training from him, and his farm is called Firefly Farm. Then we have the UT, University of Tennessee Extension Agency here within Montgomery County, Clarksville, that can provide also extension mentorship, also an internship. And then also we have the NRCS from here locally in Montgomery, Clarksville area that is also signed up. So we have this really broad availability, and we're building this as I'm speaking. You know, I'm always looking for different host organizations, farms to be a part of this program. Again, we're concentrating just on the 50 miles right now, Fort Campbell, but as we branch out in the next 2 or 3 years, we want to be able to have farms all across the state of Tennessee, you know, from east, middle, and west that can host veterans who want to learn agriculture. So, and they will basically come through us. We'll do the coordination and everything, and they will go ahead and meet up with that host and start their internship. So again, it's only 8 weeks right now. For transitioning service members, it's within the last 6 months of their time in the military.
Okay.
And kind of how it rolls is like my interns that I've had, and I've hosted 3 already, is that when they
Wow.
come out, they can't do more than 40 hours a week. And what I like to do is I teach them, of course, some stuff about floriculture, horticulture, agriculture as a whole. And also I coach them on just transitioning out of the military. So it gives me a chance to talk to them and say, hey, look, have you got your finances straight? You know, have you got all your equipment cleaned up? You know, what we call central issue facility or CIF gear,
Yes, safe gear.
TA-50. Okay. So they have to go and turn in all that. They have lots of VA appointments that they got to do. They also have some just out processing stuff to do. So I look at that 8 week time is not only just to learn what's going forward about, you know, your next career that you might want to do, but also you're learning about life after the military. You're getting a little bit of, you know, experience. And most of our host farms are veterans also. They're veteran owned. So, and that's really, some aren't, but some are. And they get that type of, you know, one-on-one discussions and really, you know, and we get to share our stories, our transition stories, you know, of this worked for me, or hey, this didn't really work for me. So maybe not go that route, you know, maybe do something else. Plus, we talk about small business. We talk about building small businesses. You know, you know, a lot of times I do more sit down talking with them than we're actually out in the field sometimes, because not every day are we pulling weeds, so and not every day are we putting a plug in the ground. So there's times where I can actually do some mentorship. I can do some real one-on-one talk with them.
What's been the
What's been the interest so far from the veteran community outside of Camp Fort Campbell into these programs?
Into just our agriculture ones,
Yeah. Are you having
it
more demand
runs.
than you can meet at this point?
It really, I just did a career skills program briefing here on Fort Campbell,
I saw
and
that.
I had two soldiers, transition soldiers, that came up to me and were asking. One of them was asking they wanted to look into having a cattle operation, and I was like, "Well, fantastic! We have an internship operate. We have an internship host who's a cattle operation, so we're going to try to hook them up with that." Then the other soldier came up, and he was a he's getting out, but he's a former drone operator. And I'm like, I was like, man, I was like, we have somebody in it, in mind that wants to be a part of the program, but we just haven't signed him up yet. But so I took his name down and everything, and hopefully we'll have somebody signed up soon, that can go
Gotcha.
over some drones in agriculture, which we do have some around here locally, Montgomery County, Clarksville. It's just we have to go out and get in touch with them.
Right.
But again, those were two totally different things, that they were interested in. And I've had some ask me about aquaculture, and hydroponics, all just everything. It really
Yeah.
runs the gamut of all kinds of stuff that they want to get into.
Are you, do you know, John Castelaw, General
I
Castelaw.
sure do. I
Yeah,
sure do.
okay. When you,
I've worked with him in the past.
I figured you might. When you mentioned the drone program and out in
Yes.
Tennessee, I don't know how far he is from you geographically, but
About an
everyone
hour and
asks
a
me
half.
about. Okay.
Yeah, about an hour and a half. I've gone down there to their business and stuff. I've worked with them in the past. We did a project many years ago at a state park, working with the state fire agents and stuff through the Department of Tennessee Department of Agriculture, and we worked with them, kind of doing relay to go out and actually look for smoke and stuff. It was after the Gatlinburg fires that we had here in Tennessee that they really put some interest on it. And a fantastic tool to be able to use for that type of job. But yeah, John's a great guy. He really is doing great things.
Compared to the level of preparation that you had coming out in 2017 and 18 versus the baseline of these soldiers coming out, how do those two compare, in your opinion?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. So when I sat in the career skills program briefing on Fort Campbell at the it's called the SIFLTAP. It's the Soldier for Life Transition Assistance Program. So I sat in that brief and I looked around, and there's about a good 65, 70 soldiers in there. And I looked at the programs that are available for them today, and it's amazing all the things that they have today. There are so many different foundations, transitioning foundations. There's all these, extra, skill bridge, a DoD skill bridge, the career skills program, all these opportunities, and also even LinkedIn, getting a full class on how LinkedIn works, which is an amazing platform. And I'm like, if you don't take advantage of those things nowadays, you're really, just doing yourself a disservice, because they're literally knocking on your door saying, "Hey, come over here and do this," I didn't have that. I had to really, during the time I was transitioning out, there were some that were there, but they weren't as really impactful and deep as they are now. And I think it's just amazing now. And again, if there's so many opportunities, it really would just be a disservice to yourself not to take advantage of them now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I didn't even hear about the maybe the old name is the DoD Skills Bridge Program. I've heard you and Bryce refer to it as the Career Skills Program, but I think it's the
Right.
same thing. That wasn't even
It's
on. Go
it
ahead.
is. It's similar. They
Okay.
have CSPs throughout the United States, and that's the real amazing part, is that you can get approved to do a CSP outside of Fort Campbell and go somewhere else and do these. It just obviously there's these different levels of approval that you got to get, obviously, for your paperwork. But I'm blown away at everything that's available. I wish I would have had the opportunity to have an agricultural internship my last, 8 weeks of military
Right,
service.
right,
I mean,
right.
I would have
Yeah.
probably been about 2 or 3 years ahead of where I was when I first started, and that's the
Yeah.
truth. So,
I hate to go back, but I do want to
sure.
ask you about this. You started farming in 2001 on your
Yes.
property while you were still
Yes.
in the Army, while you were still with the
Yes.
160th. How did you do that?
Well, I was in the 101st. I came back to Fort Campbell. I wanted to go where the helicopters were, where the fun was, where, where real wartime thinking was, and that's why I wanted to come back to Fort Campbell. It was somewhere I came here in the mid-90s. I left actually to go to flight school and do a tour in Korea, and I got the chance to come back in 2001. And I was like, I want to come back. So when I came back, I decided to I wanted to have a small farm. That's something I wanted to have. So I came back on a mid tour. I looked at about 32 houses in about a 2 day period, and the last house I looked at is the one that I'm actually still living in today. A little 5 acre property, but a little tiny house and a little tiny garage. I was assigned to the 101st 7th Battalion, 101st Airborne Division at the time, as a Chinook aviator. And then I got here in August of yeah I got here August 30th 2001, and again the 9/11 happened just a few weeks later. I was already trying to get my farm kind of going. I had 5 acres. I was all motivated. I went and bought all the fencing supplies that my local Rural King department store had. I was setting up my fencing because I wanted to have horses. And that's what I started out with, was having some horses. My stepdaughter at the time, she wanted to have some horses, and I was like, okay, sounds like a pretty cool thing. So got a few horses, but in the meantime, my life under the new 9/11 world was just starting. So I built the farm while I was doing my deployments. My first couple of deployments with the 101st, they were a little bit long, couple of 6 month deployments. In the early time, 2002 time period. And then once I came back in 2003, I decided I wanted to assess for the 160th. And then I was also building my farm at the time, and my stepdaughter was getting into junior rodeo. All right. So I was like, this is a challenge. I think we can handle this. So I had about four or five horses at the time. They were all barrel racing horses, pole bending. They were roping horses. And I basically built a full little ranch on my farm. And my deployments were increasing more, but at the same time, kind of my schedule would be when I was coming home from my deployments, depending on how long they would be, either a month or two or something, and I would come home and we would have a rodeo ready to get, for that weekend. So I would usually get home on a Thursday or Friday, get off the C-17, go home, clean up real quick, check in, make everything's good with the unit. And then I'd jump in my truck and the horse trailer, and we travel to Alabama or Arkansas or Kentucky or somewhere. And we do a rodeo, and then I come home and show up for work on Monday and do the same thing over again. So we did that for about 5 or 6 years, I think, straight. And then I got out of doing the horses, and I decided I wanted to have a couple little some cattle going on. My stepdaughter decided she didn't want to do any more rodeoing, so she was more interested in boys and trucks at the time. So the rodeo thing went away, so the horses went away also. But the cattle stayed because I had a couple of roping cattle. So I decided I would go and process these cattle for a freezer beef. Had no idea what I was doing. Had no idea about regulations and anything like that. All I know is I took it to the processor. They processed it for me, and I brought a cooler of beef to my work and to the office. And I opened up the cooler and I said, "Hey, would you guys be interested in buying any of this stuff?" And they were like, "Yeah, sure." So I was like, I don't know how to price this, so I just started selling it. And I was selling my, filet mignons for like $1.99 a pound. So I didn't know how to price any of this stuff. So they're all buying up all my beef, and I'm like, well, this is pretty cool. So that started my beef freezer beef world. So I got into more into the freezer beef. I did some research on Texas Longhorns. They're really beautiful animals itself. They're gorgeous. And also their beef was had a little bit more leanness, a little bit more healthy, at the time is what I believed. So I found a niche market that wanted that beef, and I started selling the freezer beef. Again, I'm still in the military. I'm still doing deployments. My ex-wife at the is now looking after the cattle. And everything while I'm gone. Fences are being broken, everything. I had to rely on friends to go, put my cows up or go
Right.
feed my cows while I was on deployments, especially, during the wintertime, it was hard. And go break ice, when I'm, 3,000 plus miles away and I got to go break ice here in Woodlawn, Tennessee. And then again, it was a challenge. But it was a very good challenge and I loved it. And then about 2015, 2014, 2015 is when I found my calling in being an advocate for veterans to agriculture. I was contacted, reached out by several people here in Tennessee. And also I had talked to Farmer Veteran Coalition out in California,
Absolutely.
Michael Gorman, who was the founder of it, and we became good friends. Started working to get Tennessee on the map as a state that supports our veterans agriculture, and I've been doing that ever since. And it's been probably one of the other most rewarding things I've ever done. It's been fantastic.
Yeah,
When I
they're a powerhouse in that aspect of connecting veterans to agriculture.
Yeah, I just, I love being able to just watch, a newbie, a farmer newbie, really have a dream and then start to build themselves up and to having their own operation. It's so great to see. It really is. It's
Yeah.
an amazing thing.
And in almost all of these conversations that I have, that sense of purpose that you described as lost during that transition
It is.
is found again
I
in agriculture. And it takes a lot of
Yes.
bumping around sometimes and trial and error and mistakes before they settle back on this profession as not only a profession, but also a place to find meaning again and greater purpose and service.
Exactly. And it's just that's the thing I'm, always putting when I do my talks or speeches or anything, I always tell them, agriculture gave me that new purpose, motivation, and direction. It provided, something that I could get up every day and know I have something to do every day. And that's what keeps me going. It really does.
A huge thanks to Charlie Jordan for sharing his journey and the lessons he's learned along the way. Transition from military service to agriculture isn't just about learning a new trade. It's about finding a new sense of purpose and community. Agriculture, much like the military, can be that new sense of purpose for veterans. And I think Charlie did a great job showing one way in which it could take shape. He also highlighted the importance of mentorship. Having the right people in your corner can make all the difference when stepping into something new. Whether it's through the Tennessee Ag Vols program or simply reaching out to others who have walked this path before, finding that support can be one of the keys to a successful transition. If Charlie's story resonated with you and you'd like to get involved, you can connect with Charlie on LinkedIn. You can go to Facebook and search Ag Vols Opportunities on Farmland, or check out the Ag Vols website at tiny.utk.edu/AGVOLS to learn more. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag Podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSalle, and until next time, stay frosty.